going to turn it on. Those of you who were here a few weeks ago for my last talk, I won't put you on the spot, but a few of you were, I remember. But you will remember the story I told about the Buddha being approached by a man who asked him a whole lot of philosophical, metaphysical questions. And the Buddha replied with a metaphor. He said, when you are struck by an arrow, you don't stop to ask what the arrow was made of, who made it, etc. You want someone to remove the arrow and take you out of your pain. And then he said, I teach suffering, the cause of suffering, and the end of suffering, and the way to end suffering. Those are the four noble truths. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the end of suffering, and the truth of the way to end suffering, which is the Eightfold Path. In other words, how to remove the arrow. So tonight, I thought I'd talk about another teaching from the Pali Canon, where the Buddha uses the image of another sharp object, a dart, or in fact two darts, to describe how we experience suffering. So let me read you a little bit from this section. So this is in the voice of the Buddha teaching a group of monks. Monks, he says, when the uninstructed worldling, that's the translation that means, that's referring to all of us. Basically, we are uninstructed worldlings, as opposed to monks and nuns who have received the teachings. When an uninstructed worldling experiences a painful feeling, he, she, sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. Suppose a man were to be, or a woman were to be struck with a dart, and then immediately afterward with a second dart, so that he or she would feel a feeling caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldling experiences a painful feeling, she feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. While experiencing that same painful feeling, he harbors aversion toward it. When he harbors aversion toward painful feeling, the underlying tendency to aversion toward painful feeling lies behind this. I mean, we all pretty much have an underlying tendency towards aversion to painful feelings, don't we? And attraction to pleasurable feelings. That's pretty much hardwired into our very cells. Even the simplest one-celled organisms move towards what will benefit them, nourishment, and pull back from what will harm them. So this is, you know, pretty fundamental to our makeup. And what the Buddha's saying, though, is that he's talking about physical pain, and so we have the pain of the initial physical sensation, but we also have the pain of our mental reaction to it. And that's where we have some room to work with this, our conditioning around unpleasant, or our aversion to unpleasant sensations. He's talking about physical pain, but this teaching just as easily applies to emotional pain. And when emotional pain is the first dart, and our reaction to it is the second dart. I'll come back to that in a little bit. he continues, when experiencing painful feeling, he, the person, seeks delight in sensual pleasures. For what reason? Because the uninstructed worldling does not know of any escape from painful feeling other than sensual pleasures. So how often when we experience something unpleasant, do we immediately reach out for something pleasant to counter that or distract us from that? The Buddha says, and I'm going to paraphrase this next section, is that we do this because we're ignorant of the truth of impermanence, that all conditioned phenomena arise and pass away. So whatever this unpleasant sensation or experience we're having is, it will arise and pass away. And the other thing that we're ignorant of is the truth of what causes our suffering, which is our self-clinging, our self-focus, our view of our kind of narrow self-interest. And that when we let go of that narrow self-view, clinging to what we want and what we need, our suffering is eased. The Buddha describes this state of a person who is free from self-clinging. If he, she feels a pleasant feeling, he feels it attached. Oh, sorry. this is the state of clinging first. He feels it as attached. If he feels a painful feeling, he feels it attached. If he feels neither painful nor pleasant feeling, in other words, a neutral feeling, he feels it attached. This, monks, is called an uninstructed worldling, who is attached to birth, aging, and death, who is attached to sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair, who is attached to suffering. Then he turns the whole situation and describes it again for, he says, monks, when the instructed noble disciple, so when the instructed noble disciple experiences a painful feeling, he does not sorrow, grieve, or lament. He does not weep, beating his breast, and become distraught. And he continues that whole sequence. For the instructed noble disciple, who is then, when experiencing that same painful feeling, harbors no aversion toward it. If he feels a pleasant feeling, he feels it non-attached. If he feels a painful feeling, he feels it non-attached. If he feels a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he feels it non-attached. This, monks, is called a noble disciple who is non-attached from birth, aging, and death, who is non-attached from sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair, who is non-attached from suffering. Now, the translation that I'm reading actually says detached, and I've changed it to non-attached because I think that our associations with the word detachment are detachment seems to describe a kind of cold or feelingless state, and non-attachment is different from that. Non-attachment doesn't preclude caring and compassion. So that's why I prefer the word non-attachment, non-clinging. Remember, those of you who were here a couple weeks ago, Michael's last talk was about the Buddha's fire sermon, in which He describes how everything is burning. Our eyes, our ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind are burning with what could be called desire. And of course, we don't want to be in a constant state of inflammation, always fired up about something. But as long as we are living human beings, we need our life force. We need our faculties of body and mind to tell us about our environment and how to respond to it safely and appropriately. So rather than thinking of this flame, this burning, as something that we need to completely extinguish, which you do find in some Buddhist texts, that sense of extinguishing the fires of our passions, perhaps a more useful image, especially in the weather of late, is the image of a kind of cooling breeze or refreshing rain shower. To ease our fiery nature. In fact, there's one Buddhist writer who argues that the word, the ancient word in Pali that's often translated as extinguishing, would be better translated as banking, to bank up a fire, to keep it from spreading and causing harm. You know, there are fires springing up all over. Apparently someone in North Vancouver has been lighting them deliberately. And people have been still starting campfires and backyard fires and not being careful about containing those fires. So it's the same with our life force. We have fires that can flare up in us, right? And our responsibility is to bring awareness to those mind states so that we can regulate ourselves and keep ourselves and others safe from the potential harm of our volatile emotions. There's another teaching from the Pali Canon that I find helpful in bringing awareness to this relationship between the first dart and the second dart. The painful experience and my reaction to it. Right? And this teaching is called the eight worldly dharmas, the eight worldly conditions, or the eight worldly winds. And they are pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, and praise and blame. I like the image of these as winds because we're always kind of being blown back and forth between them. We all feel really good if we get some pleasure, some gain, some fame or recognition, and some praise. But then we're not very happy when we get pain or loss or disrepute or blame. We really don't like blame. So the Buddha puts it in a similar way, a similar sequence to his discussion about the darts. He says the worldly the worldling, the uninstructed worldling, is blown back and forth by these eight worldly winds because we don't understand impermanence and we don't understand the way self-clinging causes us suffering. But when we can face these or experience these eight worldly winds with some equanimity, not being pushed and pulled to extremes between them, then we can have ease and freedom. this set of eight worldly dharmas, eight worldly winds, I think is pretty remarkable because it covers pretty much all the different possible ways that we get hooked by our likes and dislikes and how we pursue one and try and avoid the other. So to be able to bring these to mind, I find helpful when I notice a dart of pain or loss or shame or blame that's sticking and I feel it. Because remember, the first dart is the ouch. The first dart is this sensation of pain with something that you feel stung by, right? Could be anything from an actual bee sting to your neighbor's barking dog to sharp critical words from your spouse or your friend. And then the second dart is your reaction to that ouch, which often comes almost immediately to the first. You might slap the bee, you might swear at the dog, or you might snap back at your partner because you feel blamed or shamed by or criticized by what your partner said. Has anyone ever taken a look at this book by Rick Hansen called Buddha's Brain? He has a really good chapter in here about the two darts. And and he describes what's happening neurologically when you're responding to the pain of darts. I love it when contemporary neuroscience confirms what the Buddha observed 2,500 years ago, simply by observing his own body and mind. So according to Hansen, when you feel that first sting of a dart, your amygdala in your brain sounds the alarm. Your thalamus sends signals to your brainstem, which releases stimulating norepinephrine throughout your brain. Your sympathetic nervous system signals your major organs and muscle groups to get ready to fight or flee. And your hypothalamus prompts your pituitary gland to signal the adrenal glands to release adrenaline and cortisol, which are known as stress hormones. And you're all fired up for action, right? All this stress, all this circulation of stress hormones through our bodies on a chronic basis without the physical release of actual fight or flight, right? Because we don't live such physical lives as animals do, we don't actually physically release through fight or flight so much. And all this affects our gastrointestinal, immune, cardiovascular, and endocrine systems. It can lead to anxiety and depression. And it can lead us to want to try meditation. And it's not a bad idea to do that. But it's no quick fix. In fact, people who first begin meditation practice with high hopes sometimes complain after maybe 6 months or a year of practice that it seems like they're actually becoming more aware of their own suffering than when they were half oblivious to the depths and the complexity of how our mind works. Rick Hansen in this book points out that we can experience second dart reactions even when there is in fact no tangible first dart in the conditions that we're reacting to. So if you walk into the house and you see somebody, some family member has left a big mess all over the floor, There's nothing that's actually physically threatening or hurting you. But it feels like a dart, right? We even can create imaginary darts simply by remembering and fire up those stress hormones simply by remembering or rehashing something that happened last week. And as you've probably all noticed, second darts are often followed by third darts or even fourth darts. We might feel guilt and annoyance with ourselves for not that we snap back at our partner so quickly, knowing that they were tired and frazzled. Or we might feel sadness and discouragement that after all these years, we still fall into the same old patterns. So that's another dart on top of the second dart. And in relationships, our second dart reactions can trigger second darts in the other person. And then third and fourth darts, until the darts are just flying every which way. And with any of these second and third dart reactions, the more we reinforce them by believing them and identifying with them and seeing ourselves as the righteous victims of others' bad behavior, the more we suffer and the more prone to reaction we become. We become hypervigilant, always on the defensive. And that's where this, you know, the toll of all those stress hormones starts to tell on us. So it helps. It helps to have a good measure of curiosity. Curiosity about the mind, the body and mind. To be a scientist, as the Buddha was. The Buddha was really a scientist of the mind. And that helps us to take a step back and shine the light of awareness on our own experience. And we find that as we bring more awareness to our second dart reactions, that we begin to notice differences. At first, you might notice that you're so caught up in your second dart reactions that you're not even aware of it at all. Maybe only in retrospect, looking back. Later, you may be aware when you're right at the moment when you're caught up in a second dart reaction. But you're so kind of hijacked by greed or fear or anger that you're unable to really intervene and regulate yourself at the time. But you're aware that it's happening. And then after a while, at some point, you might notice that a reaction has arisen, but you're able to take a step back and observe it and maybe choose not to speak or not to act in a way that escalates the situation. And then maybe a time will even come when that first dart will come at you and passes right through without sticking, because your mind is so open and flexible, and in Buddhist terms, empty, that you don't get snagged at all. You might not even notice until later that you didn't even react to something that might easily have triggered you in some earlier time. In this book, Hansen points out that in learning theory, these stages that I just described are called unconscious incompetence. Unconscious incompetence. That's when you're just oblivious to what your reactions are. And then conscious incompetence means it still happens, but you're noticing. Conscious competence is when you start to have a choice. And unconscious competence is when you have such freedom that you exercise those choices, or the reaction, the activity isn't even there. Yeah. That's unconscious competence. And so you've probably noticed these similar sort of stages in acquiring any kind of skill that requires practice, right? Whether it's learning a musical instrument or training the body in some way for a sport. And you probably notice that the stage of conscious incompetence is the most frustrating and discouraging, right? When you're learning something and you're really trying, but you make the same mistakes over and over again, and you're painfully aware of it. So that's, in our practice, that stage is really, can be really discouraging too, because we're more aware than we were when we started, when we were unconsciously incompetent. So that's the stage when you say, oh my God, I didn't realize what a reactive, snarky person I am, because you're paying attention. So this is when we have to really hunker down and keep practicing and work with those second and third darts. Patience and kindness towards ourselves help, and the bodhisattva vows help. The bodhisattva precepts help. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha help. But most of all, our sitting practice supports us in this steady, gradual work of paying attention to the mind. We practice slowing down, being still, breathing, noticing what arises, and letting it go. Opening to the next moment. Calming the body and mind. Opening up space for awareness, for insight. Opening up some space so that the darts that come our way, inevitably in life, don't lodge so deeply. Sometimes we can pull them out more easily. And sometimes we are so spacious they pass right through. So, I'll stop there.